I'm Alex. I'm going to talk about our work on increasing data center utilization at Green. This was a joint effort together with Zvande Aconescu and Costin Vaiciu at back home at UPB. And it started from the observation that nowadays there are a lot of high capacity networks in use. They might not necessarily look like this, but the gist of it is that they are sufficiently provisioned such that if there is any bottleneck going on, it's more likely to be at the end host than somewhere in the network. And the reason you build something like this is because you are afraid or you expect to have a worst case scenario, like say heavy old traffic, for example. Here, whenever each host is like sending flat out to everybody else, you actually need all that capacity. But in practice, it is a lot more likely to have something like this. So this is basically mixed traffic. You have some large flows, you have some short flows, you have asymmetric traffic patterns such as one to many or many to one, and also some links are simply idle. So we could say that this is a problem. The network is underutilized, we pay for capacity, but we only end up using a fraction of it. Moreover, to add insult to injury, so to speak, those servers that actually need to use the network are bottlenecked by the fact that they only utilize one single interface. So an interesting observation here is that data center servers may have multiple network interfaces. So let's assume that we have multiple network interfaces. And here is a simple example rack with four servers, one top of the rack switch, and those green links over there are going from the switch to the core of the network. A simple solution to the underutilization problem would be to multi-home these servers. That is, we add a second top of the rack switch, then we divide those links between the two switches, and finally we place a second uplink. Now, in this case, if a server actually uses the network, then it can access like up to twice the original amount of available capacity. Multi-homing can work pretty well, but it's very expensive because you have to buy the switches, you have to maintain them, you have to pay for energy and so forth. And that's why we believe we have found a better solution, which we call Green. Now, instead of adding more uplinks, we simply use the additional ports to interconnect the servers directly. We call those horizontal or secondary links. These interfaces are secondary interfaces, and the interface where the uplink connects becomes the primary interface. Now, the main intuition behind Green is that if I'm a server and I want to use the network and my neighbor doesn't, I can send data both through my uplink and also forward some of it via the neighbor. So in the ideal case, I'm getting like multi-home performance, but I don't have to actually have a second switch. Also, in order to make this more transparent to applications, we rely on multi-path TCP. This may not be the only multi-path solution, but it allows us to split one connection among multiple flows, and it's pretty available, so we just went with it. Now, another advantage of Green topology is that if we have more ports, we simply add more wires. This is a lot easier than adding more switches. And if we look at the original network from the second slide, this is what a Green 2 topology would look like. The two signifies the fact that we have been using two extra network ports. And what's more, we don't really care about the way the original networks looks like. We would like to be able to augment almost any existing topology. So we are going to regard it as a black box or black cloud, if you will, and focus on how exactly do we use those secondary links. Now, let's say that we have this rack, and the server A in this picture would like to send some data flat out to another server which is in some other part of the network. It will utilize its uplink, and it will also open subflows to the left and right neighbors. Now, you could say that, you know, mission accomplished, because we are utilizing both the uplink and the horizontal links which we have added. But it's not, you know, unthinkable to imagine that maybe our neighbors don't have ideal uplinks. So it makes sense to open more and more connections, which may end up reaching at a very large distance when we speak in terms of horizontal links. So we call this HN routing. The N may stand for some large value of maximum horizontal links that we are willing to cross. And this appears to have the greatest potential to the greatest potential to find available capacity in the network. However, it is kind of, you know, expensive implementation-wise, because the routing becomes very complicated, and the implementation itself is complex. At the other end of the spectrum, we have what we call H1 routing. That is, we are simply content to work with direct neighbors. Now, this looks like it doesn't find a lot of capacity, but at the same time, it's quite simple to implement. So now, how do we find the compromise, or do we have to find a compromise? This looked like a pretty tough question back then, and fortunately we do not have to actually answer it, because as we better describe in the paper, it turns out that using multiple horizontal hops is not really better at finding capacity. So, So basically, in green, we only use direct neighbors to follow traffic. Now, H1 routing does make things a little easier, but it doesn't actually enable green to work out of the box. So I'm just going to give you an example. Here we have these four servers, and server A would like to send to server D. Now, it will first open this connection. This is called a direct connection because we are only using uplinks, so no horizontal links. And if we look at a single packet, it will be sent to the uplink of server A. It will meet the first gateway router or something similar. This router should be well aware of server D's primary interface, so it will just, you know, go to the network and finally reach the destination. So this works because this was already working on in the original topology. Now, okay, it reaches destination. Now, let's say that we would like to use this secondary connection. Well, again, let's look at the packet. It leaves from server A secondary interface. It will reach B secondary interface because that is basically a point-to-point link, so there's no processing or smart processing involved. And now server B knows that we are only using direct neighbors to forward traffic, so it will mindlessly send it into the network. And now when we meet the same, it might be another router, but when we meet the first gateway router in the network, it will probably be confused because we are trying to reach an address which did not exist in the previous topology. So what do we do? This is fancy named the green routing problem. Basically, secondary interfaces are probably not going to be reachable by default. And we would also like to rely as much as possible on the routing scheme from the original topology because we don't want to reinvent the wheel and do any effort that is not necessary. So there were some solutions, but they're not really satisfactory because they either don't play very nice with existing hardware or they don't scale that well in the way that we would want to use them. So we have to get down and dirty and use something that we call the green addressing scheme. Basically, this is a static addressing scheme that conveys routing information to the address to the addresses themselves. And it goes like this. All addresses in a green topology are going to be seen as being made out of two significant parts. We have the server identifier and the green identifier. The green identifier doesn't really have to be like 8 bits long, but it's easier to show it this way. Now, to give you an example, let's say that we take the classical localhost address. Here, the server identifier is going to be 127.0.0, and the green ID is going to be 1. Address assignment is done like in two steps, and I'm going to use this simple setup for an example. First, we assign addresses to primary interfaces. These are called primary addresses. And there are two main guidelines here. First of all, the server identifier must be unique because it identifies the server. And the green identifier for the primary address of any server is going to be set to 1. The address assignment for secondary addresses is a bit more iterative. That is, let's say we want to assign an address to that interface. Now, the first rule is that we are going to copy the server identifier from the neighboring server. So that primary address was 10.0.2.1, and we are going to copy the 10.0.2 part. And secondly, we choose a green identifier which is unique among all addresses that employ the same server identifier. In a similar manner, for this address, we again copy 0.2, but now we use 3 because 1 and 2 are already taken. And briefly showing you that we can also add these addresses for these particular interfaces. Now, this addressing scheme has two main advantages. It might not be obvious right now that they're good, but we got a lot of help from them. Basically, it's easier to distinguish between primary and secondary addresses because a primary address always ends in 1. And second, if we have a secondary address, we can simply replace the green identifier with 1 and get the primary address of the neighbor. Going back to the previous example, now we have also added some addresses there, and we are going to see how this enables us to make that particular subflow work. Now, again, this packet will start from server A's secondary interface, which has the address 0.2. It's going to go to server D's secondary interface, which has the address 10.0.3.2. Sorry. So, once again, it will make the first hop effortlessly, and it will be sent into the network. And now, when it reaches this router, it is enough for the network to simply know that all addresses which start with the server identifier of server C must be sent that way. This is not unlike the way the RSS for hypervisors is configured when they act as basically switches for the virtual machines that they nurture. So, in this scenario, if the network is configured in that way, this packet will effortlessly make its way to server C. Then, only based on local information, we can steer it towards the final destination. Okay, now green works, but how do we actually use it? There are at least two ways. The first is opportunistic usage. This means that we don't really change anything in the way that we use the apps. We simply install the links, install the software implementation, and resume our previous activity. We have evaluated opportunistic usage in a number of settings, each with its own advantages and disadvantages. We had a simulated 120 server topology. This enabled us to try, you know, various configurations, but we could not make that work at for very large numbers of servers because we have very few and very, you know, slow machines. Secondly, we have also deployed Green in a very, very, very small local cluster where we could build 1 gigabit and 10 gigabit networks. And finally, we also attempted a somewhat larger deployment of 1,000 C3 large instances on Amazon EC2. Now, here we can get some kind of feel about how Green works at scale, but the drawback was that we had to rate limit the interfaces to 100 megabits per second. Now, we started with some synthetic traffic patterns, and I'm just going to mention random traffic here because it is one of the worst scenarios for Green. In this kind of traffic pattern, we have a number of active servers, and each active server is going to send some data, you know, flat out to a destination which is picked at random. Here, there are the results we got from simulations. So on the horizontal axis, we have the percentage of hosts which are actually sending data. And on the vertical axis, we have the bandwidth per connection. So this red line refers to what would have happened in the original network. Obviously, the bandwidth will decrease because as more and more servers become active, they are going to clash at the same destination. And overall, since this is the average bandwidth, we are going to see a decrease in performance. Now, this is what a multi-home topology with one additional switch would look like. This is what a Green 1 topology would look like, a Green 2 and a Green 3 topology, finally. What we see here is that not entirely unexpected, Green topologies do a lot better when there is a small number of active servers, and then kind of sharply decrease because if neighbors become busy, then performance also drops. However, we were, well, relatively or even fairly confident that usually we are going to end up finding ourselves on the left side of that graph. Now, we also tried to replicate these experiments on in the other scenarios that I described earlier. There is more information in the paper. I'm just going to say that the results match pretty well. And also, there are a lot of, well, not a lot, but there are other traffic patterns where Green does a lot better, like many-to-one traffic, for example. Next, we wanted to see how some applications will react to Green. These results are obtained in the small local cluster, and also they represent more or less, in fact, no, they precisely represent an upper bound on performance because we only ran those applications without any kind of background network traffic. So for a 1 gigabit per second network, we were able to improve quite significantly the performance of NFS for files which were larger than 1 megabyte, because otherwise the overhead of setting up the transfer prevented us from seeing any relevant results. We were also able to significantly speed up HDFS deployment. And finally, as you can see, we could also speed up Xen virtual machine migration. We have also evaluated some applications at 10 gigabits per second. Here it became somewhat more complicated to get relevant results because our machines were pretty old and they were very quick to become CPU bound rather than network bound. So we had to, you know, help them do a lot better. What this usually meant was to, you know, have a server and then start multiple clients which eventually managed to make the server use all its interfaces. So, for example, for NFS, we had to start up 2 clients and transfer some pretty large files in order to make the server basically sent at 20 gigabits per second because this was a Green 1 topology. And we also tried to create a small Spark deployment where we had like 3 workers which were pulling data from one HDFS node. And there we had to start 3 of them in order to again make that node send data at 20 gigabits per second. Well, hopefully this sounded like pretty good, because now I'm going to talk about the negative impact of opportunistic usage. There were like three main issues. The first and probably the most obvious, or at least one of the most obvious, is that we are going to have to deal with the fair use of uplinks. So in this picture, if the red and green connections actually happen at the same time, what is going to end up looking like is what's showing in this picture. So they are going to evenly share server B's uplink. This might or may or may not be what we are expecting, but it's not unthinkable to make it desirable for server B to receive priority over its own uplink. So what we did, it's pretty obvious. We employed a simple DSCP-based prioritization scheme, where direct flows will receive high priority while secondary flows receive low priority. So those flows that only use uplinks are considered to be high priority, and every other flow is low priority. Now, the result is basically what you would expect. A single high priority flow is able to fully utilize a link regardless of how many other low priority flows are trying to do the same thing. And this was confirmed by a lot of experiments, both in simulation and in the actual implementation. Second issue was that of latency. We are using more capacity and we are thus unwillingly creating more buffer pressure. And one particular instance of negative impact that is endemic to green is the fact that multiple secondary flows might end up negatively impacting a direct connection. So there are more or less two places where this is going to happen. We either clash on the uplink of a server when we leave into the network, or we meet at the egress port of a switch somewhere in the network core. And, the delays can be pretty significant. For example, in the first case, we could get delays of up to 1.7 milliseconds, and in the second, delays of up to 2.3 milliseconds. Fortunately, we discovered that the same prioritization scheme that we used before also more or less solved this problem. In the first case, we were able to reduce the delay to around 240 microseconds. This may not look that significant, but this was like a simple software hack, and we expect with a proper implementation of a prioritization in software to get a lot better results. And second, in the second case, our switch was able to honor the DSCP and hardware, and we could reduce the delay to 10 microseconds there. We believe this is pretty much insignificant, so let's just leave it at that. So the last but not least issue is that of forwarding overhead. Basically, those compute-intensive applications that unluckily find themselves running on a server which does also does forwarding may suffer because of this. And we watched three cases. We did the kernel compilation in RAM disk. We did video transcoding, and we also ran a memcached server. The results can be summarized as this. Server which was doing forwarding handled 10 gigabit per second traffic in both directions. And we had two cases here. If we can afford to reserve a single physical network core for forwarding only, then the impact is more or less insignificant, less than 1%. However, if those applications really, really want to use every CPU core, then the overhead is a lot larger than that. It's between 8 and 13%. This could be considered significant. However, there are multiple ways to consider here. First of all, this only happens while we are forwarding traffic. Our machines are pretty slow, and also maybe there's a trade-off somewhere that is acceptable. However, if this isn't entirely unacceptable, we have also envisioned something that we call zero overhead forwarding. Sorry. What this basically means is that we identify exactly what kind of processing goes on during forwarding, and we either eliminate some of it or we show that we can safely offload it in hardware. So we have packet differentiation, which means that server B here, for example, has to know which packets must be forwarded and which packets are destined for the local machine. Fortunately, there are hardware filters that already do that, so basically we can receive packets in different queues without the servers actually looking at them. Then we have hurdle-free rewriting. For example, at each step, the server is going to rewrite the destination MAC address. We show in the paper that this is not really necessary. And finally, we need queue bridging. That is, we have those packets there. We know that they must be sent on the uplink, so we would like to use some hardware feature to do this. Unfortunately, this is not really possible. This is the missing piece of the puzzle. And a similar functionality is available from transmit to receive rings, but for the same interface. However, this is somewhat similar to what we're trying to achieve, so we hope that in the near future, rather than in the far future, this is going to be available. Finally, we have Greenaway applications. This basically means that we take a distributed application and modify the scheduler, such as the tasks are placed in a way which does not cause problems for Green. As a simple proof of concept, we modify the HDFS name node. Whenever a client requests a block, basically it will receive a list of replicas and it will attempt to contact them in the order that it receives. We made a small change that is to return that list of replica, and we sort it based on expectations of availability for the uplink of each of those replicas. And the heuristic is based on the last recommendation time. The results are this. Basically, we get an increase for green alone, and we get further increases for an optimized version. The differences aren't that large because it is a naive heuristic, and also we had some bad interactions between our servers, HDFS, and rate-limited interfaces because this was done on EC2. However, we believe this shows that modifying applications for grid can be worthwhile. Well, in conclusion, green can bring, we believe, significant performance for underutilized network. Its advantages, main advantages, are that it is cheap, incrementally deployable, and it can be used with any existing topology. And we also believe that green web applications can be used to lessen some of the negative impact. So thank you, and if there are any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them. Well, that is one question.
Masoud?
Hi, I'm Masoud Moshe from USC. My question is that, like, you are borrowing uplink resources from adjacent servers.
Yes.
Can we extend this to other type of resources like disk bandwidth or any other thing?
Well, probably for, you know, applications which are amenable to parallelization in that context. But to be honest, we haven't thought of that. It could very well be possible, but I cannot give a definitive answer. We are going to take this into account, however, because it sounds very interesting.
I see.
Any more questions? Dan, could you come up? Okay. Let's thank the speaker.